News Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. In the fall of 1975, a man who would become president of the United States a little more than a year later, peanut farmer and past Georgia governor Jimmy Carter, answered questions from the La Crosse media on Newsmakers. We're marking the 40th anniversary of Newsmakers by featuring a pair of interviews from the 1970s on today's show. 14 months before the 1976 presidential election, Jimmy Carter was asked to assess his chances of becoming president and to assess the chances of other leading Democratic candidates.
Well, I fully intend to win. I'm not going to withdraw. I'm not interested in being vice president. I'll be there when the last vote's counted at the convention. I think it would be a political miracle to have a deadlocked convention. We've not had one in the last more than 50 years. And not even a threat of one since we changed from a two-thirds rule into a 50% or majority vote requirement for the nomination. I don't see anybody now on the political scene that I think can beat me. I have a total commitment to the campaign. I have scheduled, for instance, this year outside of Georgia, 250 days to campaign. I've already campaigned in 43 states. The first delegates will be chosen in Iowa. A recent poll there, rather in April, showed that I was ahead of all the other candidates. The second and third states will be Oklahoma and Mississippi. All this will be during February. And then we come to the first primary state, which is New Hampshire. And I would say there it's a race between me and one other candidate. In Florida, which would be very important, it's a race between me and one other candidate. And I would say that coming out of Florida primary, which will be quite early, March the 9th, as has been the case in the past, there won't be more than three of us still left who are politically alive. And I certainly expect to be one of those.
Who are the other two?
I think Wallace will still be a candidate. Wallace was a candidate for president in 1964 and lost, in 68 and lost, 72 and lost. He'll lose in 76. There's no chance that Wallace would be on the ballot itself. Last election, 1972, Wallace carried every county in Florida, 67 counties, and got 41% of the votes, and then came to Michigan later and got 51% of the votes. So that'll be a very severe test. Wallace can't win overall, but he can very well be a formidable opponent if he should do well in that early test. Who the third one would be, I really can't say. At this point, I don't know who's going to stick to it. It may be Udall, it may be Benton, it may be Jackson, it may be Shriver, or it may be Bay. It's just hard to say at this point. But I think that by the time we've gone through those first five or six states, and before we get to Wisconsin, which is on April the 6th, it will narrow down between me and one other person, plus Wallace. I would guess that Wallace, if he's still able, and I presume he will be, would be a candidate in 1988. He's a perennial candidate. He has a very tight-knit group of very dedicated supporters, about 20%, plus or minus 5%. He has the ability to raise large sums of money. He spends very little, as you know, in the campaign. You never see a Wallace billboard or television spot. And he is a perennial candidate. I think it'd be about a 50-50 chance that before the convention is over in July, that Wallace would be a third-party candidate.
Patricia Lowe, Channel 19 News. Your key campaign promise seems to be a consolidation of federal agencies, similar to what you say you've done in Georgia. Now, how do you propose to do this, through a merger or by a process of elimination?
Well, I would expect to pattern it to some degree after what we did in Georgia, which was a complete elimination. We had 300 agencies and departments in the Georgia government when I was elected, and we abolished 278 of them. We cut administrative costs more than 50%, put into effect a unique budgeting system that we've had now for 4 years called zero-based budgeting, where we strip down to zero each year the Georgia government, start from scratch, and we eliminate every program that is no longer effective almost automatically. And also we put into effect a long-range planning system which has let the Georgia people control after understanding the government. And the same mechanism would be used. What I would like to have and what I expect to get is authority from the Congress to reorganize the executive branch of government subject to subsequent veto by the members of Congress. This is feasible and urgently needed, and I think would be a very attractive thing to the electorate in 1976. I have an advantage in having been through the process myself as an engineer and a scientist and a businessman. I happen to be the only candidate who is likely to run in 1976, by the way, who's not a lawyer. And I think it's time for someone to get in and have a competence and a complete total dedication and a campaign platform promise substantiated by election in 1976 that I will do this. There's no doubt in my mind that it needs to be done. There's no doubt in my mind that it can be done.
How much money, Governor, would you think that this could save the American taxpayer?
Well, the first year that I put into effect in Georgia, we prepared two budgets, one with the same level of services, I might add, one with the old structure of the government and the other one with the new structure of government. The difference between the two budgets was $60 million, which was about 6% of our total state budget. I think this would be a possibility in the federal government after we've had, I'd say, by the year 1979. You can't do it instantaneously. But there's a real possibility of cutting back administrative costs to the government substantially. And that, in Georgia, amounted to about 5 or 6%.
Do you feel your lack of foreign policy experience limits your insight into the difficulties of the presidency in any way?
No, I would not defer to any of the other candidates in my knowledge of foreign affairs. All my adult life, I've been an active traveler around the world. For instance, in the last 2 or 3 years, I've been in 11 foreign countries on official visits to meet with people like Dr. Helmut Schmidt in Germany, or Mr. Rabin or Mrs. Meir, or Mr. Eben or others in Israel, and to meet with Mr. Miki Tanaka and others in Japan and so forth. I've visited the Far East and Middle East, South and Central America, and Europe. In addition to that, I've had very good experience in working with the leading, I'd say, opinion shapers in the international field. I probably have as good a group of advisors on foreign affairs as anyone has ever had, possibly since Franklin Roosevelt's time, in domestic and international matters. And I think I have a good knowledge of foreign affairs. I don't know, you know, all there is to know, obviously. But compared to other candidates who are running or who might run, I would not defer to them in any way about my knowledge of foreign affairs.
In a speech you gave last December, you seem to advocate a strong domestic policy on the part of the American government and then say that they should really concentrate on their foreign affairs secondarily. Now, I think that would be a good idea, and according to what other presidents have said before they got elected, so did they. So I'd like to ask you, why do you think you can be different?
Well, there are two or three premises that I think can be detected in the analysis of our past experience. First of all, we haven't had a governor elected president since Franklin Roosevelt. And right now, with the Vietnamese War over, there's not nearly the preoccupation with foreign affairs that there was in 1968 or 1964 or 1972. Even among those who are crucially interested in foreign affairs, there's a general belief that the best way to effectuate any sort of viable foreign policy is first to get our domestic house in order. So the American people once again trust government, so the government is competent, well organized, and so we have clear policies. We have no foreign affairs policies that anybody can understand. In our dealings with Japan, or the People's Republic of China, or South and Central America, or the African nations, and we've had a debilitating series of blows to us that have been brought about by several, I think, misapplied foreign policy commitments. The major thing is that the American people have been excluded from participation in the evolving or the carrying out of foreign policies. There's one other aspect of foreign affairs, and that is that there's a growing realization, even among the most isolationist groups of people, that our country cannot withdraw from an active leadership role in foreign affairs. Every decision that's made in the community of nations affects everyone in this room and everyone who's listening to this program. In areas like freedom of the seas, a stable economic structure, an international monetary fund, food provisions, the acquisition of scarce commodities, including oil, bauxite, molybdenum, zinc, cobalt, and so forth. Almost every aspect of life on an international scale affects everyone in Wisconsin or in Georgia or California. So we can't withdraw from a leadership role. The rest of the nations look to us as a natural leader. I think our leadership in the future, though, is going to be based on a few different premises than in the past. For instance, we ought to have our influence in the world affairs based not on military might or political power or economic persuasion, but on the fact that we are right and honest and decent and open and truthful and compassionate and predictable. that the foreign policy of our country accurately represents the character of the American people. Also, it ought to be a bipartisan approach. In addition to that, we ought to avoid, like a plague in the future, the military involvement of our country in the internal affairs of other nations, unless our own security is directly threatened. And I personally believe that we have excluded our own natural friends and allies and trading partners from a close relationship with our country by an overemphasis of detente. I certainly want to have a maximum interrelationship with Russia and China and other countries so that we can understand them and they can understand us. But to subjugate our natural friends, say in South and Central America or Europe, to Russia or China, in my opinion, has been counterproductive. So there are a lot of things that we can do in foreign affairs field that would restore confidence in our own government. The main thing, though, is to have the American people and our own character be exemplified in foreign affairs for a change, which it hasn't been in recent years.
You're listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. We're marking the 40th anniversary of Newsmakers in the La Crosse area with a 1970s interview featuring then-presidential candidate Jimmy Carter.
Governor, you mentioned cleaning up our domestic house. Two of the main problems we have right now are grain sales to Russia and busing.
Yes.
Would you answer how you would propose to clean up the busing issue and the grain sale issue?
All right. Since they're not related directly, I'll take them one at a time. I'm not in favor of forced busing. We've been through this traumatic and very challenging decision-making process in the South for the last 15 to 20 years. I think the best thing that ever happened to the South was the integration of our schools and the granting of complete citizenship rights to our minority citizens and the passage of the Voting Rights Act. It removed from around our necks an albatross or a millstone of racial prejudice which had existed for many years. And this has been a liberating experience for us and the white people and for the blacks. So far as I know, in this whole country, every civil rights leader who has so far expressed a preference has endorsed me for president. So I'm completely acceptable to those who are very militant on the subject of racial equality. But I think busing is the wrong approach to it. Voluntary integration in the South has been a notable achievement. I have a 7-year-old daughter who was born after we had been married 21 years. She goes to a typical South Georgia school, very conservative area, rural area. I'm a farmer. But Amy had a classmate analysis last year, 13 white classmates, 18 black classmates, a black teacher, a white principal, and she's getting a superb education. It's what I prefer. She can read the New York Times or the Milwaukee paper, whatever, without any problem. But when we have gone to the proposition of forcing children to be bused away from their own home or local community, schools, to a distant school, it's been counterproductive. It's resulted in either whites moving out or the rich people putting their kids in private schools. You never see rich children get bused. Just the poor kids, black and white, get bused. We've worked out a system in Atlanta that has worked with our very militant black leaders like in the NAACP or SCLC and the white leaders as well. It has four simple elements, and I can be very brief. One is that any child that wants to be bused can be bused at public expense. Secondly, that the busing must contribute to increased integration. You can't be bused away from a school just because it is integrated. Third, the black leaders must be adequately represented in the decision-making processes of the school system to assure the black kids are not cheated. And fourth, no child is bused against the wishes of a child. This has worked for us, and I think it would be a good approach to the busing system. I'm not in favor of forced busing. On grain sales, to change the subject, we've got to have aggressive sale of grain overseas. Mr. Butts has been a very detrimental factor in the economic structure of agriculture, and also he's had a tendency through his inept leadership to separate the consumers of this country from the family farmers. In my judgment, what is best in this nation for the family farmer is also exactly what's best for the consumer in the long run. But this insight has been lost. A lot of people in this country don't realize that every year, with a normal harvest, we have to export 2/3 of all the wheat we produce. We can only consume about 1/3 of our total wheat. So we've got to have an aggressive sale of wheat overseas, plus soybeans, plus rice, plus tobacco, plus corn, and so forth. This is crucial to us. It's also our best export item, and we have a flexibility now to produce more products for export. But they ought to be done under tight constraints. In 1972, Mr. Butts sold too much grain overseas. Well, the only people that benefited were the grain speculators and the food processors and the Russians. Certainly we did not benefit. The farmers did not benefit. I don't think that would be repeated. We now have a much more careful monitoring system over sales to Russia. I would not sell additional wheat or grain to Russia until we are sure that our supplies domestically are okay and adequate. And I would also not sell grain to Russia in preference to our natural friends and allies like Japan and Europe and other countries who are regular customers of ours every year. But after those needs are met, I would sell grain on a competitive basis to any country overseas. It's got to be done.
It's rumored that U.S. negotiators are in Moscow now negotiating a wheat for oil, oil for wheat deal. How would you feel about that?
Well, that's just a paper shuffling deal to which I don't object. I think to sell wheat for gold is a pretty good bargain, but I think Russia ought to pay top prices. As you know, in 1972, we really paid Russia to take our wheat. And a lot of the wheat that we sold them at extraordinarily low prices with government subsidies, I might add, was then sold to countries like Japan and India that didn't have enough wheat because we were so ill-advised in what we did. But I think for either gold or currency based on gold or oil, all of those are equivalent. I think one thing that we might do is to level off the violently fluctuating orders of Russia for our wheat. They have in the past only bought wheat when they had a crop failure in Russia, like this year. I think we ought to require them to buy wheat on a long-time competitive basis, and I would certainly get top prices for them with currency that can be equivalent to gold.
Would you comment on Kissinger's Arab-Israeli plan, which calls for civilian American civilian advisors in the Middle East?
Yes. I know Mr. Kissinger very well. He's been to Atlanta to visit me and my wife. He and Nancy have, and I've had long discussions and debates and arguments with Mr. Kissinger within the last 7 or 8 months about different aspects of his foreign policy. Some things that he does I really like. He's a brilliant personal negotiator. I think Kissinger is quite often inclined to create a much greater disturbance that would ordinarily exist and then have the appearance of being a savior for mankind with a highly publicized unilateral approach to diplomacy. He's excluded the American people, the Congress, Democratic and Republican leaders, I think sometimes possibly the president, from the process in order to look like the savior of the world. I think he's also much too inclined to get us militarily involved in the internal affairs of other countries. He's much more inclined to want to favor highly publicized examples of the success of detente than to have a stable approach. He's also much too inclined to spend his time outside this country. But I think in this particular instance, between Egypt and Israel, he's done right to go there. Both sides want him. I think the most explosive potential area of the world is in the Middle East, in Israel. And I think through his repeated, very tenacious approach to this problem, he's worked out a fairly good solution. I don't know the details of it. Nobody knows yet. But I would personally favor the sending of the 150 to 200 non-armed forces technicians to man those lookout posts, which will use infrared and radar-type surveillance on both sides. They are isolated from both battle lines. Both sides want those few technicians to be there, and I think that's a very small price to pay and a very slightly dangerous price to pay for the possible solution to the Middle Eastern problem, at least for the next 2 or 3 years. I believe they would be heavily protected by Egypt and by Israel. So I think that I would approve in this instance, the sending of those technicians. My personal preference, by the way, would be to send someone from the United Nations or from Sweden or Norway or Switzerland. But my understanding is that both Egypt and Israel have insisted that they be American citizens in order to be trustworthy. And another thing is that this greatly enhances our posture in the Middle East, I think with very little danger, in fact, a slighter danger of our being involved militarily in those affairs.
Governor, a lot of people up here are worried about natural gas shortage this winter and probably some of the next winters. And some of the energy-producing states, Texas, for example, just passed a law prohibiting natural gas sales to other states until all Texas needs are clearly met. Now, what are you going to do to resolve this inequity between energy-producing and non-producing states?
Well, let me digress just for a minute to say something that's politically important. President Ford has been a totally inadequate leader. There has been no leadership qualities exhibited by President Ford since he's been in the White House, except in one area. He's been very effective in pursuing an energy policy for this country. He's just a spokesman or a mouthpiece for the major oil companies. There's no way to tell where the Federal Energy Agency starts and the oil companies start. They're the same people. President Ford's energy policy is very simple and very clear. Raise the price of oil and gas as much as possible, as quickly as possible, period. That's it. This works into the hands of the major oil companies. I would not have deregulated and would not deregulate the price of old oil and natural gas. Secondly, as they become inherently and inevitably scarcer, those supplies need to be distributed by government interference, if necessary, equitably among the states to make sure that this very same thing that you point out does not occur in the future. We're going to run out of oil and gas very quickly. We've now got about 30-year supply of oil, for instance, in the whole world at the present rate of consumption. It's going to be much more scarce in the future, and we're going to have much more critical needs for it. The deregulation of old oil and gas does not help us at all. The domestic price for oil and gas overall has been, oil at least, has increased 200%. It's tripled in the last 2 years. International prices have more than quadrupled, as you know. And the price of new oil discoveries is still uncontrolled. So I think to have a better energy policy for this country would be to develop one for the benefit of the consumers themselves and not just the oil companies. We need to shift from oil to coal, distribute scarcer and scarcer supplies equitably among the states, hold down the price of oil, for instance, and gas goes with it, at least $3 or $4 below international oil prices, freeze the level of present oil imports at about 40%. 2 years ago it was only 25%, and have strict conservation measures.
Governor, can you beat the president on economic policies, and if so, how and where?
Well, I think so. You've seen President Ford's status or popularity drop precipitously since he became president, and especially the last 2 months. I think he started off up with a very highly rated opinion among the people. That's now dropped down to about 35%. 60% of the people that were polled by Gallup and Roper and Harris recently indicated that Ford was not capable of solving their economic problems, with an opinion with which I agree, by the way. So I think that by the time next year comes around, Ford is going to be quite vulnerable to someone like me who can tie together the various elements of the Democratic Party in a common effort. Ford has been compared so far in integrity with Richard Nixon, which would make anybody look good. And he's also been compared, as far as executive leadership is concerned, with the Congress, and this would also make any president look good. But when Ford, and he still only has a 38% favorable rating among the voters. So by the time next year rolls around and the Democratic convention chooses myself, hopefully, as a nominee, he'll have to face me personally and not capitalize on his relationship with Nixon and the Congress, and also debate the specific issues on which he has been so inept. So, yes, I think I can handle him very well.
How are you going to solve the economic problems? What's your solutions?
Well, of course, it's hard to describe in a few seconds how I'll solve all the economic problems, but I'll tell you briefly what needs to be done. The first emphasis needs to be placed on unemployment. We'll never have a balanced budget, which I really would expect to try to get, nor an end to the inflationary spiral, as long as we've got 8.5 or 9 million people out of work who are actively looking for jobs, plus 2 or 3 million more who have given up hope and are now no longer in the job-seeking market. The first emphasis needs to be placed on jobs. Another emphasis needs to be placed on low interest rates. Another emphasis needs to be placed on an aggressive sale of American products overseas, on a revision of the tax structure to remove the incentives that have encouraged American multinational corporations to manufacture products overseas when their own employees were out of work here in this country. Another one is the coordination of the horrible, bloated, bureaucratic, confused mess that exist in Washington. So for the first time, the President and the Congress can work together, the federal, state, and local levels of government can work together, and so that the government, industry, labor, manufacturing, agriculture can work together toward common goals. The last thing I might mention is that the people have to have their confidence in this country and its government restored, and they need to be reminded that inherently we are just as strong economically as we were 5 years ago when everything looked rosy. We've got the same capacity for production, the same purchasing power among our consumers, the same potential foreign markets, the same basic natural resources as we had then. We just lost our purpose, lost our confidence in the future.
The future president and former Georgia governor, Jimmy Carter, was a guest on Newsmakers in September of 1975. The moderator was WLSU's Terry Rochester. In January of 1977, Jimmy Carter would be sworn in as the 39th president of the United States. Carter's not the only presidential candidate to appear on Newsmakers. Illinois U.S. Senator Paul Simon, who ran for president in 1988, also appeared on the program. You're listening to a special 40th anniversary episode of Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, another 1970s Newsmakers interview with psychologist Timothy Leary, whose research into psychedelic drugs made him one of the most controversial figures of the 1960s. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.